Heard from who? Candace. The blowjob queen. Hey, Justin said. She wants to give me a header, I'll take it. That's because you got no standards, Zach explained. You telling me you wouldn't like to nuzzle those tits? She's a fat cow is what I'm telling you. Big tits isn't the same as fat. Justin appeared to have strong, confident views on this particular subject. Fat is stomach and waist and thighs. Big tits is a whole different thing. Zach wasn't terribly interested in this abstract physiology argument, or any of Double Dibble's other opinions either. So what if Tick was in love with some faggot from Indiana or someplace? Like he was supposed to care? Zach was fast coming around to his father's point of view on the subject of girls, who seemed to inhabit this earth for the sole purpose of fucking with your head. They're not happy unless they get under your skin, was how his father had explained it, back when he was trying to make Zach understand about his mother and all the trouble and why she left. They never come at you straight, his father went on, like a man would. They just nick away at you, a little nick here, a little nick there. At first you don't even think you're bleeding, then the next thing you know, you're a quart low, maybe two. But they had you over a barrel, too, his father always added. What could you do? Turn into a fag? What do you bet we find a bunch of queer magazines under his bed? Zach said. This possibility had come to him last night, and he'd been turning it over in his mind all day. Until they'd played the game, Zach had figured the kid was a total wimp. Now he didn't know what to think, because Justin was right. The kid hadn't flinched. He'd held the barrel right to his temple and pulled the trigger like it was nothing. Of course, if he was a queer, that made sense. He probably figured he was better off dead anyway, so what the fuck? What do you mean, we? I told you I'm not breaking into any house. It's not breaking in if you have a key. If we get caught, we'll just say the door was unlocked, and we just stopped by to see if our buddy John wanted to hang out. No big deal. He's gonna freak when he finds out. Why? What's he so afraid of? This fucking kid who didn't flinch. He's probably, like, ashamed or something. Ashamed or something. What's that, like Indiana or someplace? Maybe his grandmother's this crazy lady who pisses in her stockings or talks in tongues and shit. I don't like anybody meeting my parents either. My old man raises up on one cheek to fart. His corduroy chair's got this smell you wouldn't believe. My mom sleeps till noon and wanders around in a robe all day. I'm sure they're real proud of you too, Zach said. Crouching low, they crept along the tree line toward the dilapidated house in the pale light of an almost full moon. In the car, Zach had doubted both his purpose and his resolve, but being on his feet and moving made him feel strong and sure. Justin, the pussy, had wanted to wait in the car, but Zach had insisted he come this far. If a passerby stopped and asked Justin what he was doing just sitting there in the dark, he'd piss his pants and blow the whole thing.
What if she's got a shotgun or something? Justin whispered, when they'd made it as far as the stand of pine trees 20 yards from the back porch.
The same crazy old woman who pisses her stockings has a fucking shotgun?
I lived all the way out here with no neighbors. I'd have one.
Why are you such a pussy? He shrugged.
What am I supposed to do while you're in there?
How should I know? Think about Candace's tits and jerk off.
Okay,
Justin said. And with that, he pretended to do as instructed. This was the dangerous part, Zach thought, as he moved out across the weedy lawn toward the back of the house. For 20 yards, he'd be in the open, visible in the moonlight from both the road and the house. Maybe girls were a mystery, like his father said, but to Zach, fear was an even bigger puzzle. The way it came and went, the way it made no sense. That's what the game was all about, really, and the reason he'd invented it in the first place. If the gun was empty and you knew it, if you'd taken the bullets out yourself and you double-checked to make sure you hadn't missed any, then the fucking thing couldn't shoot you. If you knew anything in the world, at the instant you pulled the trigger, you knew that. Why then, was it so hard to do? Why, if you weren't this fucking Voss kid, did you flinch? He wished now that he'd never introduced him to the game. Almost wished he'd never invented it. In the beginning, it was fun, watching people freak out when they saw you do it. Tick had been the worst. He'd known better, even at the time, than to play the game with her. But he'd gone ahead and done it anyway, though he never expected her to go completely ballistic. Afterward, showing her all over again that the gun was empty, that there hadn't been any danger at all, only seemed to make her madder, and she refused to speak to him till he promised never to play again. Now he wished he'd kept the promise. In breaking it, he'd hoped the news would get back to her and she'd realize it was because of how she was treating him. Except the whole thing had backfired. He knew it made no sense, but seeing this Voss kid not flinch had fucked him up somehow. Two nights in a row, he'd lain awake thinking about it, knowing this fucking kid had upped the ante to the point where the next step was to spin a real bullet in the chamber, and then they'd see what they were really made of. He could feel that awful necessity growing inside him, and part of him was glad. The other part, the late-at-night part that couldn't sleep, was scared, probably even more scared than that shit-scared Fairhaven pansy who kept pretending to have headaches. But maybe, Zack thought, as he scurried across the lawn toward the porch, there was another way, because there was something inside this house that John Voss feared more than any gun. He was almost at the back porch steps when the ground suddenly dipped, which sent him lunging forward to regain his balance. And with his next step, he tripped over what felt like some kind of iron rod sticking out of the ground. He went down hard, narrowly avoiding impaling himself on the spike. His shin burned, and through the ripped denim of his jeans, he could feel warm blood. His first thought was that he'd stumbled into a horseshoe pit, but then he discovered that a thick chain was attached to the top of the spike, the sort of chain that you might find a large dog on the other end of, or in the house. The possibility of a mean-assed dog hadn't occurred to Zack until that very moment. He just about concluded that this whole idea was too fucked up when his foot brushed against something wooden, and he found there on the ground, against all laws of probability, the very thing he needed if there was a dog. A baseball bat. He went up the porch steps as quietly as he could, and when the top riser groaned under his weight, he cringed in anticipation of a volley of barking, but none came. He paused at the back door, listening, but the house was silent. And after a minute, he leaned the bat in the corner and took from his pocket the set of keys his father was always boasting would open any door in Dexter County. The third key on the ring worked, and the door swung open into darkness. After a few minutes, it occurred to Justin Dibble that the suggestion his friend had offered in jest wasn't such a bad idea, so he unzipped his fly and went to work. It took a while, and he had to stop once when a car slowed at the sight of the Camaro parked there on the shoulder, but then sped off in the direction of Fairhaven. Justin had barely finished when he heard a sound and saw a dark figure trotting back across the lawn, and he only just managed to tuck himself in before Zack arrived back at the stand of trees. Justin was afraid that his friend would guess what he'd been up to, but his thoughts were clearly elsewhere. Even in the pale moonlight, Justin could see his eyes were gleaming with excitement. But all he said was, "This is so fucking great!" Chapter 25. Tick has learned several interesting things about Mrs. Rodrigue. For instance, that her favorite painter is Bill Taylor, who has a show, Painting for Relaxation, on the local access channel. Taylor's specialties are old rowboats and the rocky main shoreline, and most of his paintings contain both of these features. Amazingly, he manages to complete a painting start to finish during his one-hour time slot. And when he's on location, instead of painting from a photograph or postcard, that hour includes the time it takes him to set up his easel. He prefers to work in watercolors, freely admitting that oils slow him down. He always keeps a battery-operated hairdryer on hand so he can blow-dry the freshly applied paint and save precious seconds. In truth, Tick does like to watch him work on TV, and she can't help but admire the way he attacks the canvas, Taylor's own phrase, something she knows she has to learn. Where her own strokes are tentative and often fearful, Bill Taylor's brush never seems to do anything that causes him regret or even misgiving. To Tick, it seems as though his arm, wrist, hand, fingers, and brush are all an extension of his eye, or perhaps his will. When he does make a mistake, he just chuckles and says, "Never mind, we'll fix that later." And sure enough, he does. Tick knows there are many secrets she has yet to discover, and she looks forward to the day when she, too, will have dozens of good tricks with which to magically transform mistakes. But what she'd most like to acquire is the whole attitude. Nothing in her experience suggests that mistakes rectify themselves in the fullness of time, and certainly not in an hour. Quite often, it seems to her, there's good reason to be alarmed by them, the most indelible things on her canvas. For instance, she's made the mistake of being Zach Minty's friend again, an error in judgment based in part on his insistence that he changed, which he has, for the worse. Zach always had a frightening, smoldering quality, as if he might at any moment burst into flame. But lately, he seems already on fire, someone to step back from, though Tick seems to be the only person to notice the difference. John Voss is another mistake, though befriending him was the principal's idea, not hers. In some ways, John is the exact opposite of Zach, a boy whose tiny flame is flickering for lack of oxygen. At first, his job at the Empire Grill and their lunch arrangement seemed to be doing some good. But over the last few days, he's become even more darkly silent than before. He shows so few signs of life that Tick half expects to look across the blue table at him and find that he stopped breathing. Between these two and Candace, who as usual is driving her crazy, she doesn't like to think what her life would be like if Donnie hadn't finally contacted her with his email address, or if she hadn't convinced Walt, who she'd have to start being nice to eventually, to get hooked up to a server. She'll actually see Donnie in less than a week, and when she thinks about this, her throat gets full and happiness comes over her so powerfully that she has all she can do to conceal it from her friends. Love is what this happiness feels like. What she suspects, but would like to know for sure, is whether Mrs. Rodriguez is in love with Bill Taylor. Tick has met Mrs. Rodriguez's husband, who is also named Bill, a man who resembles a human bowling ball. The reason their marriage has been so successful, Mrs. Rodriguez tells anyone willing to listen, is their shared devotion to the Lord. But Tick imagines Mrs. R. has a secret devotion to Bill Taylor, who is tall and lean and somehow elegant, with a full head of unruly hair. To Tick, he resembles one of his own paintbrushes, and she can't help wondering whether Mrs. Rodriguez regrets ending up with a bowling ball when there was a paintbrush not so very far away on the coast of Maine. If so, she's made a mistake that has not rectified itself in the fullness of time. To Tick, Mrs. Rodriguez's love life is not that pleasant to contemplate, but neither is the possibility that there is no such thing as love for certain unfortunate people. She would like to think it's a possibility, if only as a long shot, for everyone. Mrs. Rodriguez certainly speaks of Bill Taylor as if she were in love with him. She says she wonders every year if there might be a budding Bill Taylor among her young apprentices, and yes, from time to time, she sees potential. But then, in some way or other, all of her students seem to fall short. His style, she adds dreamily, may in the end be unique. Last week, Mrs. Rodriguez gave her students the Bill Taylor assignment of watching painting for relaxation in order to discuss the great man's technique in class on Monday. To the teacher's grave disappointment, Tick alone had watched, though she'd forgotten it was homework, and saw the program only because she usually did. Bill Taylor's show, despite its title, contained more genuine suspense than anything else on television. At times, say with only 10 minutes left, it didn't seem possible he could finish the day's painting. But you were always wrong to wager against a man who wielded a brush with such vigor. Sometimes he finished with only seconds to spare, without even enough time for a proper goodbye to his television audience. But somehow he always completed his painting. Dick isn't sure how to feel about this. The fact that he always finishes adds to the suspense each week, but sometimes Tick finds herself hoping something will happen to prevent him, like a gust of wind tipping over his easel and scattering his brushes. But then she feels guilty for wishing failure on this poor man, which is sort of like going to an auto race hoping to see an accident. Tick would have been interested to know John Voss's thoughts on Bill Taylor, but she doubts there is a television at his grandmother's house.
"So, Christina," said Mrs. Rodrigue, clearly
disappointed to have to carry on this important conversation with her least favorite student. "How would you describe Mr. Taylor's style?" Tick knew the correct answer, of course. The word Mrs. Rodrigue had in mind was of the sort that might have been printed on one of those scenic postcards that Bill Taylor painted from. A word like sublime. Why not give it to her? Instead, she said, "Fast." The most disturbing thing Tick has learned about Mrs. Rodrigue is that she's related by marriage to the Minties, which may be why Zach always has a hall pass bearing her signature. This allows him to leave his study hall once or twice a week to join her and John Voss in the cafeteria. Ever since Tick made it clear that she's not interested in being his girlfriend, Zach has intensified his ridicule of the other boy to such a degree that she's considering telling Mr. Meyer what's going on. Even with a pass, Zach has no business being in the cafeteria or jimmying its lock when they won't let him in. And she knows that if the principal knew anything about it, Zach would get in trouble, maybe even be suspended from the football team. She's also debated telling her father, except she's afraid of what he might do, given how much he despises Zach's father. She should do something, she knows, for John Voss's sake. But at times, he almost seems to feed on the abuse. And if he won't do anything in his own defense, why should she? And so for now, she has decided on a policy of appeasement, feeling that even though her influence on Zach is greatly diminished, she still has some. And she fears, too, that if she told him she didn't even want to be his friend anymore, he'd be capable of far worse. Tick is fully aware of the dangers inherent in this policy, since they're studying World War II and European history, and the consensus seems to be that Hitler should have been confronted sooner. Tick doesn't disagree exactly, but she's mystified why her classmates seem so blind to the costs of open hostility. Last week, they were shown a movie that began with the D-Day invasion of Normandy, and even before the first American soldier, a boy not much older than Tick, had been shot in the head when the big doors to the amphibious troop transports were lowered into the surf, Tick felt her left arm growing numb, and she had to rest her forehead on the cool desktop to keep from being ill. 10 minutes into the film, Mr. Meyer had come in and helped her out of the classroom. So for now, anyway, appeasement. And if she's wrong? At the bottom of her backpack is the stolen X-Acto knife she hasn't yet returned to the supply closet, though she's had countless opportunities. Sometimes, when Zach's tormenting John Voss in the cafeteria, or like today, visiting art class on some flimsy pretext so his friend Justin Dibble can join in the sport, Tick imagines pulling out the knife and swiping it across his wide, stupid forehead. "So, John," her former boyfriend is saying, "how's your grandmother? She doing okay?" The boy doesn't acknowledge this question or even look up from his painting. The class is now working in watercolor, Bill Taylor's favorite medium, and Mrs. Rodrigue, apparently weary of her student's subject matter, has brought in a vase of flowers and set it up in the center of the room, temporarily rearranging her color-coded tables into a large U so everyone has a good view of the floral arrangement. In this new symmetry, Since all of the tables are identical, there's no differentiating blue from red until someone sits down, thereby establishing the table's identity for the day. Every day this week, Tick and the Voss boy have arrived early and established a different table as blue, today choosing the one closest to Mrs. Rodrigue's desk. This was Tick's idea, actually. She was curious to see what lengths the woman would go to in order to avoid paying Blue any attention. So far, and the period only has 10 minutes to go, Mrs. Rodrigue hasn't even looked in their direction, except when Zack entered a few minutes ago and sat down next to Candace. Though obviously Zack doesn't belong here, Tick is just as glad to be ignored by their teacher. She finds it difficult to paint anything with someone watching over her shoulder, and of course she feels duty-bound to ignore any artistic advice of Mrs. Rodrigue's anyway. Since she described Bill Taylor's style as fast, she sensed that the woman's opinion of her, never high, has fallen precipitously.
"Is that a smart-aleck answer?" she demanded. Tick assured her that it was not, but the teacher continued to look insulted on her idol's behalf.
What Tick wonders now is whether she'll be accused of doing a smart-aleck painting. At the center of the bouquet is a monstrous peony, probably purchased on sale at the supermarket. By Tuesday, its curling petals had begun to collect at the bottom of the vase, infusing the room with the faint but unmistakably sweet odor of corruption and imminent death. Tick knows that what Mrs. Rodrigue intended is for her students to paint the peony as it had appeared on Monday, when it was still beautiful, at least to her way of thinking. In Tick's opinion, there was something extravagantly excessive about the peony from the start, as if God had intended to suggest with this particular bloom that you could have too much of a good thing. The swiftness with which the fallen petals began to stink drove the point home in case anybody missed it. As a rule, Tick leans toward believing that there is no God, but she isn't so sure at times like this, when pockets of meaning emerge so clearly that they feel like divine communication. She realizes it's entirely possible that this is simply Tick communicating with Tick, but she is willing, largely in deference to her father, who believes in God and wishes she did too, to keep an open mind. Her apprehension about the watercolor has to do with her decision to depict not the peony's beauty, but rather its rancid decay. The other smart-alecky thing is that she's painting the shapes of her fellow students, the ones who are facing her as they paint the flowers, into the background. While this hasn't been strictly prohibited, Tick's pretty sure Mrs. Rodrigue hasn't intended for anyone to see beyond the flowers themselves. She will also not be pleased to see that Tick has painted one of the tables green, the one next to it brilliant red, or that behind them is the boxy, hovering shape of the teacher herself.
"You're one lucky dude, John," Zack sang, "having a grandmother to take care of you, I mean."
Tick cannot help but turn and stare at him, though she doesn't indulge this need for more than a second. With John Voss sitting there, of course, there's no way to say the obvious, that if he weren't spectacularly unlucky, his parents would be taking care of him. In fact, for the last few days, for reasons Tick doesn't understand, Zack has been taking every opportunity to insert the boy's grandmother into every conversation, saying what a fine woman she must be, and how he'd like to meet her sometime. Didn't they think she'd make a good subject for Community Heroes, a monthly feature on the local TV channel? Earlier in the week, when Zack first suggested this in the cafeteria, John Voss had looked up from the sandwich Tick had brought for him, and the expression in his pale, watery eyes had confused her, even frightened her, though she couldn't say why. Now he seems to have removed himself and gone to a place even farther away.
"Hey,"
Zack says, nudging Candace, off on a new tack now. "I thought of a good name for Tick's new boyfriend." Except for the fact that there's a boy she likes who lives in Indiana, Tick has revealed nothing about Donnie, not even his name. So in retaliation for her secrecy, Zack has come up with this new name game.
"Hickman," he says, snorting loud enough for everybody over at the red table to hear.
Get it? I mean, the boy's from fucking Indiana. For the last few days, he's been openly flirting with Candace, trying to make Tick jealous. Strange. When Zach did this with other girls last year, she simply couldn't control her own feelings of hurt and betrayal, even rage. Not giving a shit, she's decided, is like the defrost option on a car's heater that miraculously unfogs the windshield, allowing you to see where you're headed. It's now Candace, poor girl, whose windshield's all foggy. She broke up with Bobby, the boy who may or may not have been in jail, even citing Zach as the reason why. According to Candace, Bobby's out now, and rumor has it he's coming to Empire Falls to find this minty asshole who stole his girl and kick his ass. Clearly, she can't quite believe her good fortune to have Zach Minty interested in her, which shows she's not entirely stupid, Tick thinks, since he isn't. What he'll do is continue flirting with Candace until he's sure that Tick really doesn't care, and then he'll tell people it was all just a joke. What Tick's coming to realize is that in some way Zach's never been interested in her either, though not, she suspects, in the same way he's not interested in Candace. While part of her would like to understand this better, the other part is glad she doesn't.
Oh my God! Oh my God! I've got it! Candace shrieks.
Whatever she's got is just too great. She can hardly stand it.
Is it okay if I say it?
She asks Tick. She'd like to be forgiven in advance of her disloyalty. She's been asking her all day if it's okay that she and Zach are maybe going to start hanging out. Now she'd like to be sure it's okay if she participates in this new let's make fun of Tick's new boyfriend game. Knock yourself out, Tick tells her, not wanting to deny Candace pleasure. If her windshield weren't all fogged up, she'd see heartbreak speeding right at her, its high beams on. The bell is going to ring in just a few minutes, and what Tick would like to know is whether her painting is finished. That's one of the many things Bill Taylor is always so sure about. She'd also like to know whether Mrs. Rodrigue will recognize herself looming out of focus behind the red table.
Goober,
Candace says with a peal of laughter.
Goober Hickman.
Zach Minty turns to regard her deadpan. That's really funny. Laugh, I thought I'd die, he says. And the girl's laughter dies in her throat.
It's as funny as what you said,
Justin Dibble offers, causing Tick to glance in his direction. She catches his eye for a split second before he looks away. She has long suspected he's fond of Candace, that his teasing her has been intended as a courtship ritual. Since Zach began flirting with Candace earlier in the week, Justin has been wearing an expression of hurt and betrayal, though he hasn't openly broken ranks until now. Tick wonders what the cost of his doing so will be. Zach may be pondering the same question, because he does not register his friend's challenge except to include him when he turns his attention back to silent John Voss. Let's let John Voss decide, he suggests. Hey, John, the subject is Tick's new boyfriend. Which is the funnier name, Hickman or Goober? John Voss raises his eyes to look at Tick, and it occurs to her that this may be the first time he's heard about Donnie. He quickly drops his eyes again, but before he does, Tick sends him a look she hopes will suggest that it doesn't matter if he wants to answer.
Okay, how about this? Zach says, when the boy doesn't respond. Which do you think your grandmother would think is funnier?
The bell rings then, and Minty shoves his chair back and stands up, pausing for a moment to tower over John Voss, who seems not even to have heard the bell. Candace quickly gets to her feet, too, girl on a string, and after a beat, they head for the door together, Justin watching them go through narrowed eyes.
Ask her for us, okay, John? Zach calls over his shoulder.
Her painting, Tick decides, is finished, for the same reason that Bill Taylor's paintings are always finished, because the hour is up. Chapter 26. He recognized her voice immediately, though it had been nearly 4 years at his high school graduation since he'd heard it last. "Hello, dear boy," she said, and the hello was all it took, the dear boy merely confirming and intensifying his visceral reaction. Was this what criminals in the witness protection program felt like when they were recognized on the street by a former associate? "I've been trying to reach you for days. I'm afraid you'd better come home." Just that quickly, everything in his life changed. How long had it taken to make the arrangements? 15 minutes? Had he spoken or merely listened? Later, he was unable to reconstruct much of the conversation, but he had not resisted. Of that much, he was sure. After all, he wasn't in the witness protection program. He was Miles Roby, and his mother was dying. The reason Mrs. Whiting hadn't been able to reach him was that his roommate, Peter, and his girlfriend, Dawn, had convinced him to join them on Martha's Vineyard over the long Columbus Day weekend. It was Indian summer in southern Maine, and it would be even warmer in Massachusetts. Besides, wasn't it Miles who was always telling them how beautiful the island was? He told them about the vineyard so that they'd understand that he'd been somewhere besides Empire Falls. Except that he couldn't really afford it, there was no reason not to go. He'd already made an excuse not to go home over the long weekend, telling his mother that between his regular classwork and his editorial responsibilities at the school literary magazine, he was swamped. It occurred to him now that when they'd spoken on the phone last week, she'd sounded almost relieved. He'd gotten good at coming up with excuses to avoid Empire Falls, and since his sophomore year, had managed to spend very little time there. Peter's parents owned a seafood restaurant on the Rhode Island coast, and the last two summers, Miles had worked for them, in the kitchen the first year, out front as a waiter the second. It wasn't a fancy restaurant. They served mostly clam and shrimp baskets to tourists, but the money was good, and Miles had very few expenses. He'd been allowed to stay for free in a spare bedroom that had been Peter's older brother's, so he was able to save nearly all of his earnings for tuition. Peter's parents seemed to like him, and he liked them, too, especially their easy affection for each other and their common cause when it came to doing things in the restaurant, always making each other's tasks lighter, their eyes constantly feeling out the other from across the room. His experience at the Empire Grill stood him in good stead, and he made himself indispensable, unlike Peter, who seemed determined to convince his parents that he was entirely dispensable. He was always wanting days off to go to the beach or to visit the three different girls he was stringing along, one of whom was Dawn. If Peter's parents hadn't forced Miles to take a day off now and then, usually a slow Monday or Tuesday evening, he would have worked straight through the summer from Memorial Day to Labor Day. When they offered him time off to go home, they accepted his excuses without actually believing them. Peter, Miles suspected, had explained that his parents were poor and that the money he was earning was nothing short of a godsend. The truth was that Miles had come to dread even the rare, brief, unavoidable visits to Empire Falls. He hadn't been a college freshman for more than a few weeks before deciding that this was where he belonged, among people who loved books and art and music, enthusiasms he was hard-pressed to explain to the guys lazing around the counter at the Empire Grill, talking the Bruins and the Sox. Even harder to accept, did he even understand it himself, was his increasing sense of estrangement from his own family. Getting to know his roommate's parents so well, witnessing how much they loved each other, he'd seen clearly for the first time that his own parents' marriage, far from a sacred union, was a kind of sad mockery, a realization that made him especially angry with his mother. He'd have been angry with his father, too, except there wasn't much point, since Max wouldn't notice for one thing and wouldn't care for another. Grace's feelings, however, could be hurt, so Miles hurt them by suggesting in various subtle ways what a fool she was for not leaving a man like Max. Anyone so foolish, he implied, probably deserved what she got. Could leaving have resulted in more misery than staying had? He was even prepared to tell his mother she'd have done better to run off with that Charlie Maine fellow they'd met when he was a boy. At least the two of them might have been happy, instead of everybody being miserable. Except for Max, of course, who remained Max in any scenario. The problem was that Grace hadn't obliged him by saying what he'd expected her to, never once claimed to have sacrificed her own happiness for his and his brother's, a claim he felt sure he himself would have made had the shoe been on the other foot. Stranger still, Grace had simply smiled at his characterization of her not leaving Max. "I wonder what you mean by that, Miles," she'd asked him, and of course he immediately saw what she meant. How do you go about leaving a man who was so seldom around to begin with? Why would you? Do you mean that I didn't divorce him? Well, yes, that was what he'd meant, though his shrug was intended to suggest that he'd meant that and a lot more. She responded by regarding him patiently until he finally saw the truth, then concluded the issue for him. Have you ever seen a husband and wife more completely put asunder than your father and me? She also seemed to want him to understand that what she'd done was precisely what he'd blamed her for not doing. She not only had walked away from the life he considered her to be trapped in, but also had acquired another new whole family, or hadn't he noticed? And it was the second family, he realized, not the first, that was the true source of his confusion. On each dreaded vacation from St. Luke's, he'd witnessed his mother's increasing absence from their own home, even when she was present in the house. It was as if they'd both gone off to college, not just him. And just as his real life was now at St. Luke's, his mother's real life now lay across the river with Mrs. Whiting and her daughter. Miles had seen all this coming even back in high school, but he'd looked away because on the surface, things weren't so very different. His father, as far back as Miles could remember, had always been either gone or on his way to the nearest pub. The difference now was that Grace no longer cared, nor did she seem to comprehend the difficulties her own absence was causing. Right before her eyes, David was turning from a sickly, sweet-mannered child into a healthy, angry, troubled adolescent, a transition that appeared to puzzle and sadden Grace without moving her to action. With each visit to Empire Falls, it became clearer to Miles that his brother was, in essence, an abandoned child who was developing his own survival strategies, one of which was to ape his father's careless indifference and self-sufficiency. Miles could tell just by looking at David that he was one of those kids who featured in faculty negotiations each fall. The teacher who got stuck with David Roby would want to be compensated with two or three good students of his or her own choosing. "He's just trying to get attention," Grace told the high school principal when he got into trouble, and then more trouble, and then worse trouble. She said the same thing to Miles when she explained over the phone what his brother had done this time. She seemed genuinely lost and broken-hearted about the boy, but in the rueful way you might worry about a niece or nephew you'd always been fond of, but who was, after all, your sister's child and not your responsibility. But Grace also seemed unaware of what was happening to herself. With each passing season, she grew more gaunt, more ghost-like. When he asked if she wasn't feeling well, she told him she was just going through the change early. Some women did. Far from being troubled by this, Grace seemed almost grateful. Was it possible that only a dozen years ago this same woman was still in radiant bloom? That in her white summer dress she'd turn the head of every man on Martha's Vineyard? That Grace seemed to have no recollection of that woman was enough to break his heart, enough to make him find excuses to stay away, enough to enter, had the opportunity been offered, the Witness Protection Program. It hadn't yet occurred to him that this was precisely what college is. "She'll be furious," he warned Mrs. Whiting on the phone, after it was all decided. First thing in the morning, he would see the dean of students, explain the situation, and take a leave of absence. Mrs. Whiting would send a car for him, and by mid-afternoon, he'd be at his mother's bedside. Grace would remain at home for the time being and continue with her chemotherapy and radiation treatments. Was it possible that these had begun nearly 6 weeks ago, and Grace hadn't told him? But eventually, she would be moved to Mrs. Whiting's single-floor house, where it would be easier to care for her. Neither Grace nor anyone else in the Roby family had had health insurance since she lost her job at the shirt factory, but Mrs. Whiting told him not to worry about the medical bills. Old Roger Sperry, it so happened, was also ill and needed help at the Empire Grill. If Miles was willing to gradually take over and run the restaurant for a year or so until they could find and train a new manager, Mrs. Whiting would see to it that Grace had what she needed. Eventually, of course, he would return to school and finish his degree.
"She'll hate us both, Mrs. Whiting. You do realize that?"
"You always did worry about the oddest things, dear boy," the old woman replied nostalgically. Miles had no idea what she meant by this remark and was afraid to ask.
"Your mother will no doubt be angry at first, but she will never find it in her heart to hate you. Whether or not she hates me is rather beside the point, don't you think?"
"What about my daughter?" Mrs. Whiting guessed. Rather uncannily, Miles thought. "She'll want to be here, of course. You know how devoted she is to your mother. Far more than to her own, I dare say. And when she finds out you'll be here... Still, I suppose she might be kept in Augusta for the most part, if you'd prefer."
"Mrs. Whiting," Miles said. "Why would I want that?"
In response to this, silence, meaning that he shouldn't ask questions he didn't want answered.
"I understand she's doing better," Miles ventured.
The summer before last, he'd received an envelope at the restaurant in Rhode Island, addressed to him in his mother's small, neat hand, folded carefully inside a single sheet of Grace's pale green notepaper. "Cindy is not doing well," she'd written. "A card from you would mean the world." Was a newspaper clipping. C.B. Whiting's obituary from the Empire Gazette stated that Mr. Whiting, who had recently returned from Mexico, had died at home as the result of an accidental gunshot wound, the weapon having discharged while he was cleaning it. Miles would not learn the truth for nearly 2 months. He'd come home on Labor Day for the briefest of visits. Registration at St. Luke's started on Tuesday, and mentioned C.B. Whiting's accident to his father.
"What accident?" Max had snorted, then chuckled. "You put a loaded gun to your head and pull the trigger. The hole the bullet makes is no accident."
Which caused Miles to think back. Some part of his brain had registered that something about the obituary and his mother's note was odd. It was unlike her to have so little to say about such a tragedy, especially one that touched her second family so directly. And had he thought about it, he might have noted another curious thing. The obituary was long, as befitted an important man, its details filling two columns. At the top of the second was C.B. Whiting in bold-faced type that resembled the caption to a photo. It hadn't occurred to Miles when he opened his mother's letter, or later when his father revealed that the accident had been a suicide, to wonder why Grace had clipped around the photo. After all, Miles had never met the man, and wouldn't have known him, to borrow one of Max's favorite phrases, from a bag of assholes.
"And on what basis do you understand that she's doing better?" Mrs. Whiting said flatly.
"My mother wrote..." "Yes, of course. But then your mother is as devoted to my daughter as Cindy is to her. If wishing made it so, people the world over would visit our Grace instead of Lord's." Miles couldn't help smiling ruefully. The woman still had the ability to nonplus him. In 3.5 years at St. Luke's, he'd never met anyone remotely like her.
"Mrs. Whiting," he said, "I owe you an apology."
"Whatever for, dear boy?"
"I haven't been back home much these last couple years, but when I was there, I should have come to see you."
"Well, never mind that," she told him, without, he noted, denying the truth of his assertion. "You're going to be home now, aren't you, dear boy?" Of course, part of the reason that Miles hadn't realized in high school that his mother was undergoing a transformation was that he attributed her increasing vagueness about their own family to years of disappointment and exhaustion and too much responsibility. He noticed, as Max did not, or didn't appear to, that she was no longer vested in her husband, and he was troubled that Grace was so forgetful about his brother. But she was only rarely vague or distant with Miles himself. More often, her concern for his future, far from abstract, bordered on mania.
In fact, during Miles' junior and senior years, Grace had two obsessions, equally powerful. She was determined that Miles would go to college and that Cindy Whiting would attend her senior prom. Each goal seemed like a long shot to Miles. Together, they might be seen as evidence that Grace was purposely setting herself up for some sort of emotional train wreck. And it wasn't just college she had in mind for Miles. He was to go out of state, which rendered the difficult virtually impossible. Gaining admission to the University of Maine presented no particular problem, and paying for tuition, board, and books there was relatively inexpensive. The problem was that word, relative, because Miles had no idea where even that small sum would come from. Add out-of-state tuition on top of such expenses, and the idea became laughable. When he pressed his mother about why distance was so important to her, she surprised him by saying, "So you won't be able to come home whenever you want to." The Farmington branch of the U of M was less than 45 minutes away, the main campus at Orono about an hour. Kids who went there, she explained, often flocked home on weekends, and this she was determined he would not do. "I don't cross that river every day of my adult life, so my son can come running back to Empire Falls." He'd heard the phrase "crossing the river" so often during high school that it no longer truly registered. "Why do you think I cross that river every day?" she often asked him when they argued. "Why do you imagine I do that, Miles? I do it so that you won't have to." Or, "Do you think I enjoy crossing that river every day? Do you?" The way she asked such questions, her eyes wild, her voice shrill, was not without its comic aspect, at least to a high school boy. She spoke, it seemed to Miles, as if there were no bridge, as if she daily forded the Knox River's strong currents at the risk of being swept over the falls and dashed upon the rocks. But strangely, not crossing the river seemed unthinkable, and when Miles suggested that she look for another job, she reacted as if he'd suggested something not just naive, a job in Empire Falls, but also unprincipled, as if hers were the only honest work available. It was as if she'd come to see crossing the river each morning as a deeply symbolic act, and his failure to see the necessity of it illustrated just how little he understood about her, the river, and life itself. But she was no more obsessed with Miles's going off to college than she was with Cindy Whiting's attending her senior prom. The two events were linked in her mind of equal weight and significance. When his mother began to talk, a full year in advance, about making sure that Cindy had a date, Miles didn't object, because as yet he had no idea how much it meant to her, or of the length to which she would go to ensure that it came to pass. What he thought Grace had in mind was to use her knowledge of Mrs. Whiting's friends and acquaintances to locate a suitable date for the poor girl. Surely there must be some second or third cousin somewhere who might be apprised of the situation, convinced of its gravity, and pressed into service. Only when his mother asked him to keep an eye out for some shy classmate who might betray any small sign of affection for the girl did Miles comprehend the precise nature of her delusion, that a date for Cindy Whiting might be found at Empire High, a notion that struck him as only slightly more ridiculous than the idea they might find money for out-of-state tuition if they just looked hard enough. Only gradually did the basis for his mother's confidence dawn on him, and when it did, he set about the task of finding some other girl to fall in love with and ask to the prom. If he could manage this, his mother would have to come up with a new strategy, and when she failed, at least he would seem to be blameless. Falling in love, he noticed, was something people accepted as natural, something they couldn't blame you for. The problem was, he already was in love. It didn't do him any good either, because Charlene Gardner was a full 3 years out of high school, and the odds of her accepting his invitation to the senior prom ranked right up there with his mother's wishful thinking about out-of-state tuition and a romance for Cindy Whiting. Still, Miles continued to hope for a miracle. During his junior year, he'd taken a job as busboy at the Empire Grill so that he might be near Charlene.
And during his senior year, he even worked a few hours after school, 3 or 4 days a week, for the same purpose. On afternoons, when he wasn't working, he talked his friend Otto Meyer into accompanying him to the restaurant for Cokes and later coffee, which they hoped might make them look older. What confused Miles enough to keep his hopes alive when he might have been more productively engaged in trying to get some other girl to like him was that Charlene Gardner acted genuinely fond of him, despite the fact that she always had at least one boyfriend her own age or older. Being in high school, Miles had no idea there were girls in the world who might be nice to some boy who'd suffered the misfortune of falling in love with them, even when they couldn't return the favor. Charlene Gardner was such a girl. Instead of seeing Miles's crush on her as an occasion for ridicule, by far the most effective cure for a crush, she managed to convey that both Miles and his infatuation were sweet. She didn't encourage him to persist in his folly, but neither could she bring herself to treat his devotion as something shabby or worthless. Mockery and contempt Miles would have understood and accepted as his due, but affection and gratitude confused him deeply. Gratitude for her kindness clouded his judgment, and the proximity she allowed him was simply too intoxicating to give up. So he convinced himself that her fondness was merely the beginning, that if given the opportunity, it would metamorphose quite naturally into love. He made no connection between Charlene Gardner's kindness to him and his own kindness to Cindy Whiting, an analogy that might have proved instructive. Although his dilemma deepened with each passing day, no closer to finding a girl to ask to the prom while inching ever nearer to having one found for him, Miles took some slender comfort in the fact that Otto Meyer wasn't making much headway either. He too had family problems. His father, an angry, aggressive man, had recently suffered a stroke, and he returned home from the hospital madder than ever, except that he was no longer able to express his fury. The stroke flattened side of his face placid and unmoving, the unaffected side red and contorted. About all he could do was shake his huge head with rage and toss strands of spit through the air like a Saint Bernard. Though Otto was also smitten by the charms of the beautiful Charlene Gardner, he was not, like Miles, prone to unrealistic fantasies. Neither was he blind to the charms of girls his own age. So one gray afternoon in early February, when they were sitting across from each other in a booth at the Empire Grill, he informed Miles that he'd asked a girl from their class to go to the prom with him, and she'd accepted. Miles tried hard not to appear crestfallen. The girl Otto had asked, who years later would become his wife and the mother of his son, was exactly the sort Miles himself should have been looking for. She was pretty, smart, shy, and full of fun without knowing quite yet how to express this latent side of her personality. Neither popular nor unpopular, she wore unfashionable clothes at her mother's insistence, and somehow intuited, as certain remarkable young girls will, that there were worse things than not being popular, that life was long, that she would one day have perfectly adequate breasts, that in fact there was nothing wrong with her, never mind what others seemed to think. During the days that followed Otto's bold invitation, about a dozen boys told him how lucky he was, that they'd been about to ask her themselves. Once he was over the shock, it was not hard for Miles to feel happy for his friend. But Otto's unexpected announcement happened to coincide with another that same afternoon. When Charlene Gardner stopped by their booth to refill their coffees, she accused them both of not being very observant. She then wiggled the fingers of her left hand in front of them provocatively. They were enchantingly lovely fingers, and one was encircled by a tiny ring, the significance of which Miles still hadn't grasped when a motorcycle pulled up outside with a low, throaty rumble, and Charlene made a beeline for the door. The young fellow on the bike, he had longish, wind-blown hair, a leather jacket, and a chin that required frequent shaving, barely had time to unstraddle the bike before Charlene was in his arms, and then he was twirling her in the air, and they could hear her whoop through the plate glass window. Around and around the young man spun this girl that Miles would continue to long for well after she was married, first to this biker, then to two other men, even after he himself was married. When the twirling out in the parking lot finally stopped, it was Miles who felt dizzy. When Charlene came back inside to ask if she could get off her shift a half hour early, Roger Sperry nodded to her from behind the counter, and before the restaurant door could slam shut, she was on the motorcycle, which had throbbed back to life in anticipation of her return. And just that quickly, Charlene Gardner and her new fiancé were gone. "You'll never guess who my mother wants me to ask," Miles said to Otto. They weren't looking at each other, but at the space outside the restaurant window. "Cindy Whiting?" Otto said, and when Miles looked at him, he just shrugged. "Your mom called mine last week. I thought maybe you'd suggested me." Miles closed his eyes and let the humiliation of what his mother had done wash over him. "It's okay," Otto assured him. "I mean, it wouldn't have been so bad. Cindy's actually kind of pretty, don't you think?" To Miles, this seemed completely beside the point. All he could think of was the chant he'd lived with since last spring when he was learning to drive. "Go, Roby, go! Go, Roby, go!" "Plus, she's a nice girl," Otto said, which was true. And when Miles didn't deny it, he added, "Plus, she likes you better than anybody." "That's the worst part," he admitted, meeting his friend's eye. "No, the girl you love just rode off on the back of a motorcycle," Otto said. "That's the worst part." "Screw you, Otto," Miles suggested. "Plus, we could double," his friend continued. "Anne wouldn't mind. Anne Pichero was his date. I bet she'd like to get to know Cindy better. It'd be okay." Imagining all of this, Miles had to look down. "What if she thinks I like her or something?" "You do like her. You know what I mean." Now it was Otto's turn to look down, and Miles tried to think if anyone else his own age had ever suggested doing the right thing, because it was the right thing. Under different circumstances, Miles thought, he might have been grateful to Otto for risking a moral point of view. Maybe he was grateful, even in the present circumstances. What he would have liked to explain to his friend was just how needy and hungry this girl was, how she lived in a dream world, how the smallest kindnesses engendered and sustained her fantasies. But as he struggled to find a way to express this, he saw how close he was to describing his own yearning for Charlene Gardner, who indeed had ridden off into her future without saying goodbye to him, or scooping up the quarter he always left for a tip. After dinner that evening, once his brother had gone to bed and Miles had gotten out his homework, Grace came into the dining room, where he'd spread his textbooks across the table. "I want you to go to St. Luke's," she said. A small Catholic college not far from Portland, it was the most costly of the schools he'd applied to. In addition to St. Luke's, he'd sent forms off to the University of New Hampshire and the University of Vermont, and without his mother's knowledge, the University of Maine. He remained convinced that when the time came, she'd be forced to acknowledge reality. "Mom," he began. "I went to St. Cat's this afternoon," she said. Miles sighed deeply. My God, he thought, she's praying for out-of-state tuition. "Father Tom knows people at the college," she said, reassuring him at least a little. "He thinks, with your record, there's a good chance of a scholarship. He said the parish might even be able to help with your books, and it's where you want to go." What he felt like asking, no screaming, was, what does wanting have to do with anything? Instead, he simply nodded. It was what he wanted. "We'll find the money," she insisted, taking his hand. "Do you trust me?" Is it possible to say no to such a question? "Okay, Mom," he said, almost too heartbroken by her faith to speak. "Good," she said. "And now I have a favor to ask of you." And it occurred to him that perhaps wanting something really badly might not always be the most foolish thing a person could do in this world. Because that afternoon, when he returned home from the grill, and about the time his mother was crossing back over the iron bridge into Empire Falls,
he'd called Cindy Whiting.
"Oh, Miles,"
she'd said, her voice immediately rich with tears.
"Dear, dear Miles."
Chapter 27. Otto Meyer Jr. listened to the recorded message that told him the number he was dialing was no longer in service, hung up, and reached for the big plastic bottle of antacids he kept in the lower right-hand drawer of his desk. Every principal he knew kept something in the lower right-hand drawer, something to get him through the day, and Otto comforted himself that there were far worse things he could be hiding. Unscrewing the lid, he shook four or five tablets into the palm of his left hand and chewed them somberly. Before replacing the bottle, he counted how many remained through the wide, round opening. 19, it looked like. Not enough to last the week, not the way this week was going. Which meant a trip to the Fairhaven Walmart, where he could buy another family-sized bottle of generic equivalents, 500 a batch for practically nothing. The pharmacist swore they were identical to the national brands, but Otto had his doubts. More and more of the damn things were required to settle his stomach. No longer bothering with the recommended dosages, for months he'd been nuking his problem stomach at the first sign of a flare-up. The number of antacid tablets he chewed these days was based on the size of the problem that was making the acid in his stomach churn and then rise in his throat until he could taste it on the back of his tongue. Last week, after learning that one of his best teachers had gone home after school and beaten his wife so badly she had to be hospitalized, he'd recommended about a dozen tablets and followed his recommendation to the letter. When he went to visit the man's wife in the hospital the next day, and she looked out at him from between the slits of eyes swollen nearly shut, he went downstairs to the gift shop and bought a roll of the national brand and recommended to himself that he eat about half of them right there in front of the cash register. The next day he paid a visit to the teacher at his home, where he found the man sitting in his kitchen staring at a handgun that lay on the dinette table, which suggested that the correct dosage was the other half. Now this John Voss thing. The third note had appeared in his mailbox this morning. There was no way of knowing whether it had been put there today or late yesterday afternoon, after the staff had gone home. Like the others, this one consisted of a single sentence, typed, then printed out, he had no doubt, on a machine in the media center. Where is John Voss's grandmother? No salutation, no signature. The first had appeared in his box on Friday, and Otto had paid no attention, assuming it had to be the work of a crank, several of whom worked regular hours under his jurisdiction. The second appeared in the center of his desk on Monday morning, and at first glance he thought it was the same one, until he remembered wadding the original up and throwing it away. When he asked Gladys, his secretary, who'd put it on his desk, she shook her head and said, "What note?" In response to the second note, Otto ate an antacid and asked for John Voss's file. And now, with the third note and the file spread out before him, he asked Gladys to find out where the boy was during fifth period. The answer? In the cafeteria, eating lunch with Christina Roby. Otto might have remembered if he'd thought about it. He himself was responsible for this arrangement, which, Allah be praised, seemed to be working. Well, actually, he had no idea whether it was working or not, except that he generally heard about it when things didn't work, especially when what wasn't working was something he'd instigated, in which case he heard about it over and over. The only new development he could recall was the boy's dishwashing job at the Empire Grill, certainly a positive sign. True, the kid remained generally unresponsive to teachers and other external stimuli, but Otto had noticed an improvement in his appearance these last few weeks. He seemed cleaner, his hair less matted, his thrift store wardrobe less bizarrely mismatched. Was it possible he'd fallen in love with Christina Roby? Otto supposed it was. After all, the link between romance and personal hygiene was well established, and he remembered how he himself had begun to bathe after falling in love back in 10th grade with the beautiful Charlene Gardner. So maybe, They were working together. They were in the city art show together. They had lunch together all by themselves. Might all this have caused a romantic constellation to form in the boy's otherwise comatose mind? Poor Christina, he couldn't help thinking, as he swallowed the last of the chalky antacid and then went directly to the cafeteria, where he found not just these students, but also a third, Zach Minty. The big bottle of antacids that Otto Meyer kept in his desk drawer at school did not represent his entire stash. He kept an additional 3 or 4 rolls in the glove box of his Buick, and of course he also had a jar on his nightstand at home. Parked in front of the ramshackle house out on the old landfill road, chewing a couple of tablets in preparation for his interview with the boy's grandmother, he noted that the air was almost cold enough to bear snow. In another month, the 4 o'clock mornings would begin again. On days when snow was predicted, Otto and the principals of the elementary and middle schools would be up early, groggily watching the Weather Channel and listening to the State Weather Service on the radio. By 5:30, they would have to decide whether it was too dangerous to put the buses on the road. Parents, for the most part, were eager for their kids to go to school, because otherwise they would have to figure out what to do with them. Before attending to these necessary arrangements, many parents liked to call Otto Meyer Jr. at home and convey their impression that he was a fucking idiot, a lazy, no-good bastard angling for a reason to take a day off of work, as if it weren't enough he had the whole summer. If Otto was in the shower and his wife answered, they told her instead. The parents who were the angriest and most abusive on snow days were generally not the ones who had to worry about missing a day of work to attend to their children. Rather, they were the same parents who signed their kids up for the free lunch program and sent them to school inadequately clothed, but who could afford answering machines so they never had to waste time talking to principals and bill collectors. Actually, even these were not the worst. The very worst, Otto Meyer thought as he studied the dilapidated house, were the ones you never saw. The ones who seemed to exist only as narratives prepared by state caseworkers for files that followed kids from school to school in a feeble attempt to prepare teachers and administrators for what they were up against. According to the file he reviewed before driving over here, John Voss's parents, who disappeared beneath the bureaucratic radar nearly 5 years ago, had been small-time Portland drug dealers and habitual abusers who discovered after having children what a nuisance they could be when serious business was being transacted. When John was a little boy, it had been their habit to stuff him into a laundry bag, pull the string tight, and hang him on the back of the closet door, where he could kick and scream to his heart's content. After a while, he always calmed down, and then they could have some peace. The trouble with the silence was that sometimes they'd forget all about him, fall asleep, and leave him hanging there all night. Otto did not know.